The decade of the teens draws to a close, capping one wild year of news here in Northeast Florida. Just ahead, we'll take a look back and a look forward. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this Friday, we close out the year and the decade with a look back at the top stories of 2019. It's our final Friday Meteor Roundtable of the decade. You can join us, 549-2937. Give us a call. Then later in the hour, how MoCA's latest Project Atrium installation is lighting up the downtown museum. That's coming up later. But first, from the JEA saga to plenty of other headlines from the year, there is so much to talk about as we close out 2019 and the decade that was. Here with their thoughts, we welcome Nate Monroe of the Florida Times Union. Hey, Nate.
Hey.
Mike Mendenhall of the Jax Daily Record is here.
Good morning.
Regular contributor and our own WJCT board member, Charles Griggs.
Good morning.
And rounding out our foursome, writer and journalist, Nikisha Williams.
Merry Christmas, Duval.
That's right. It's almost Christmas. So here's an early present for everybody. Our final Friday roundtable of the year, our final show of the year, and our final show of the decade. And we're going to begin, no surprise, with the biggest story of the year locally, the JEA saga. As the year draws to a close, former CEO Aaron Zahn is gone. The state attorney is sniffing around, and the utility faces an uncertain future. Where to even begin with all this? Well, we're going to begin with some breaking news, and we want your calls. As we discuss JEA and everything that's happened this year around the utility, call us up at 549-2937. Let us know your thoughts at 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. Before we go through the whole history of this, let's begin with what we're learning just a few moments ago. Nate Monroe, an axe has fallen around this JEA scandal just a few minutes ago. What are you learning?
So my colleagues and I had started hearing last night that JEA's general counsel, Lynn Rohde, was gone, and that we just got that confirmed like a minute ago. So that is a major shakeup in the what they call the senior leadership team at JEA, and I would not expect it to be the last.
And let's explain why Lynn Rohde has been ousted.
Well, I think so. I don't have details on why. So I, the official explanation is not something that, we have yet. And that's probably important to note up front. She became a focus of attention because in this July 23rd board meeting, when board members approved this now infamous sort of bonus scheme, she represented to the board that plan had been signed off on by the general counsel's office. And we later learned that that was not the case.
I see. It's 549-2937 to join us. Nikisha Williams, this news today caps off a year, actually several years of controversy for JEA. We now have the president of the Jacksonville City Council, Scott Wilson, saying he thinks the utility needs to just stop taking bids from private companies, because this whole affair has become so murky, so controversial. State Attorney Melissa Nelson is now investigating. And so where does JEA go from here with all of this?
I think I've said this every time I've been on this year and discussing this topic, that they need to just stop, start over, and go back to the drawing board, because the entire time that this process first came to the light, for the public, not just the media, but for the public, it was always the maneuverings and murmurings and the machinations of City Hall with JEA almost colluding to do something that they had not presented to the people who own the utility. And now we're finally starting to see heads roll and people being called to account for their actions. And no one has ever stopped to explain why this was necessary, what was the point, and what would the city get out of it. And so now we have to have all of these investigations to bring all of those answers to light when it could have just been open and transparent from the very beginning.
Yeah, and Charles Griggs, Mike Mendenhall, that's been the knock on this from the start, that if the mayor's office and JEA leadership wanted to privatize, why didn't they ever just make the case for it to the community? Why not lay out the reasons why?
Well, they had an opportunity to do that. It's been about 2 years ago now when all of this started. And because we started from a position of this will be great for the city without explaining it to the public, people don't understand, and more misinformation has been going as ever since this process has begun. So now the only real thing to do, and I think what the public really wants to know, is how come we cannot just kill it now? I mean, drive a stake through the heart of this project before this effort, before it gets any messier. And that's what people in the community are saying. Why is it so difficult to just end it now and just kill it once and for all?
Mike Mendenhall.
Yeah, and on Tuesday when the board voted to terminate Aaron Zahn, to fire the CEO, you could feel the pressure in the room, turn to the invitation to negotiate the possible sale. And even one of the board members, Henry Brown, was like, well, can we pause this? Can we at least stop it while the new leadership gets in a role? And then one of the JA's contracted attorneys kind of alluded to the fact that there could be financial recourse from some of these nine companies. And, he was talking about the size and of these companies and even with the mounting pressure, there were still outside influences trying to keep this ITN moving forward.
It's interesting that you mentioned the meeting on Tuesday, because for many people in the community, that felt like the first time people had really had an opportunity to get real information about what was going on with this effort. And a lot of people's mind was put some would put at ease because of they know now that folks are asking the right question, but it still raises the types of questions that make you wonder, how do we get here in the first place? If you got an organization that started out with a pup plan that went awry, why would we trust them with a task such so large that they're looking at bringing in billions of dollars?
And Nate Monroe, as the state attorney, looks into this, and as the city council potentially starts sending subpoenas flying, what more do you think we can learn about where the impetus to sell the utility began and what has been going on for the last several years now with regard to elevating Aaron Zahn from a board member to CEO over more qualified candidates, clearing the previous board of members and putting loyalists to the mayor in place, one of whom, Alan Howard, ostensibly now stood to profit from the sale of JEA via a consulting contract. So there's a lot more to be learned.
There most certainly is, and we are going to learn a lot more. I mean, my expectation is that this is going to keep us busy well into 2020, and it's not going away.
And what's your reaction, all of you, to Mayor Curry saying he supports the grand jury investigation and wherever the facts lead?
He doesn't have a choice. He doesn't have a choice but to support the grand jury investigation wherever the facts lead, because at some point he's either going to own up that he had a hand in doing all of this and putting these motions into work, or he's going to sit back and see what happens. The mayor is not without words. He's a very skilled orator when he needs to be, and he can make his points and be clear and advocate for his positions and what he wants when he wants to. He could have done that a very long time ago, and we wouldn't be in this position. So now he has no choice but to sit back and see what happens.
Yeah, he speaks in these like lawyerly obfuscations and will say things like, oh, well, I've never picked up the phone and directed a board member to do something. Like, okay. Well, that doesn't mean that board members weren't instructed to take votes by the mayor's office. You know, that's the mayor's role in all of this. My colleague Mark Woods, I think, had a really nice column yesterday that knocked the mayor for this was not his word, but just cowardice. That this is a guy who presents himself as Mr. Reformer, who is unafraid to jump into the fray on some controversy, but like can hardly bring himself to mention the name Aaron Zahn anymore. I mean, this was his guy.
And let me bring up one other point before we go to callers. Charles Griggs, full disclosure, you are a member of the city's Charter Revision Commission. Right now, this body is meeting to consider potential changes to Jacksonville and Duval County's charter. It has been suggested that the city needs to change its charter and its laws so that the city's lead attorney, the Office of General Counsel, is no longer appointed by the mayor, but rather a group of independent stakeholders puts that person in, because whether it's over the JEA matter, the push to have a half-cent sales tax for schools, which we'll talk about in a moment. This office has come in for a lot of criticism over the last couple of years by those who don't see it as calling independent balls and strikes on these important legal matters for Jacksonville.
Yeah, and we did have a robust conversation. The commission had a robust conversation around the issue of the general counsel. A general counsel even came in and addressed the commission and talked about their duties. And a lot of the ideas that were shared among the commissioners, kind of went back and forth, and the commission voted to prioritize a lot of the ideas that were on the table at the time, and they all got divided up into subcommittees. Now, whether or not that comes back up is still open story, because we do have two commissioners that have a notice meeting for early January to continue the discussion on general counsel's mission and how they get appointed. I will say that one of the recommendations was that multiple people outside of the mayor have a hand in making recommendations for the general counsel.
Mm-hmm.
The current structure of the Office of General Counsel is just untenable. And I don't know how any body that's purporting to take a hard look at the charter after the last year and a half could possibly not take up the credibility of the Office of General Counsel, or more appropriately, the lack thereof. Of credibility.
And I would say there's a lot of consternation in the fact that the general counsel's office has so much power and has to cover so much landscape over all the independent agencies. And
have been in conflict with City Hall. I mean, it's really extraordinary.
And this is a prime example of how, you know, someone could be working for the general counsel's office and still be, out of touch with what the real context of what needs to happen here. And but I do believe that the commission is going to take this up again before it makes its recommendations.
Mike.
And I think it is problematic that it's hard to be an independent authority when your legal advice is tied to City Hall. You can't when you can't have an independent thinker that's representing you, in a legal capacity.
Yeah. The school board is, as we speak, suing over the half-cent sales tax matter, which we'll discuss in a moment. And it's being adjudicated as to whether they're even allowed to sue their attorney, the city attorney. So we'll discuss all of that in a minute. But first, lots of calls on our final media roundtable of the year and the decade. It's your chance to join us before we go dark until the new year. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts? 549-2937. Daryl is in St. Augustine right now. Hi, Daryl. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa, and everybody there. I just want to say thank you all very, very much. This fiasco would not have been solved and fixed if it hadn't been for all of your hard work and all of this amazing fake news that you've been delivering and getting this.
It's real news. I think you're joking around.
Exactly. Yeah. You're getting labeled as fake news, but you guys are the reason this thing got turned around. Thank you, Melissa. Thank you, the entire public broadcasting and all the other media that is out there that's so vilified all the time. So, Merry Christmas to you guys. Just amazing. And I think if you keep investigating, you will find the mayor transcript that says when he made the call to say, do me a favor. Put Zahn on the board.
Right. Okay. Well, Daryl, I can't thank you enough for your supportive comments. I really appreciate that. And in particular, I think we need to single out the Times Union for praise. And Nate, you and your colleagues in particular have led on this investigation into what's going on at JEA and fulfilled your public mission to inform the voters about what's going on with their taxpayer money and what their public officials are doing. So good job.
Thank you. I would just add that our editor, Mary Kelly Palka, her name's not on the bylines, but she is, really responsible for the internal kind of newsroom structure that lets us do some of the work, all the work that we do. And also, it's nice that I think we have the media can be sort of a cutthroat business, but I think in Jacksonville we have, you know, news organizations that, you know, we do a really good job of kind of working together pretty well, and we're really lucky in the city.
Thanks for that. Okay, lots of calls. Let's go to Tom on the west side. Go ahead, Tom.
Ah, good morning. Happy Christmas and a Merry New Year to y'all.
Yeah,
and,
you too.
Yeah, just wanted to echo the thanks that the last caller gave, because, I appreciate all the effort, too, and Nate is my hero. beyond that, I hope as a Christmas gift that what they do is they just kill this proposal and leave it dead. That would be the best thing for us, because after all, we've already spent large money pursuing this failed project, and let's not throw any more good money after bad. In addition, I hope we'll continue to investigate the other things that are swirling around the mayor's office, such as the Kids Hope Alliance microgrants and the consulting contracts. And who knows where that'll lead us in the new year. Hope it's a good one.
Thank you, Tom, for that. Getting off JEA for a moment, let's talk about some other issues now from the year that was. Now, that caller, Nikisha, mentioned another matter that's still swirling out there. The head of the Kids Hope Alliance, Joe Peppers, is on administrative leave while there's an inspector general investigation that's going on into his leadership of the agency, and also his allegation that the Curry administration improperly pressured him to commit procurement fraud, directing microgrants to politically favored faith-based groups without going through the legal process. That is still going on. We don't know whether that will be formally investigated, but it's another controversy from 2019.
I think it's ironic because formerly KHA was Jacksonville Journey under Mayor Alvin Brown, which Mayor Curry disbanded and installed it as a Kid Hope Alliance, and it was his grand answer to trying to combat crime in Jacksonville, especially after the death of 2-year-old Ada McClendon a few years ago, who was shot and killed on the east side. And so that's kind of been his baby. And I think that there was a lot of good intention in the agency and the microgrants, especially when they set up that round after the shootings at the football games over the summer and then again in the spring, trying to, like, you know, how can we help fund the organizations already working in the community? But I feel like this mayor and his personality is very bullish, and he likes to be in control, and he wants to control the narrative, control the situation. And it's almost like as if he can't help himself but trying to maneuver something and get his way and say, okay, do these organizations and these community groups, because it's politically expedient. And when you're talking about community issues and crime specifically, and it's also at the intersection of race, you kind of have to let the organizations who are doing the work in those communities do the work and fund them, whether they support you politically or not, because those are the people that you're trying to help. You're the mayor of everyone in Jacksonville, not just the ones who voted for you or who support you.
And this whole matter of funding these organizations ties into another big story from the year, which is the murder rate in Jacksonville. The crime rate has continued unabated throughout 2019. That has been another big story from the year. Charles.
Well, you're right. And this is the one that kind of tugs at my heart, because this is something that I believe as a community we should be able to pull together and do something about. We continue to let disinvestment in our community rule the day. And until we decide that this is the most important thing, the lives of people in our community are the most important thing that we can take up and we can rally around and we can do something about, we're going to continue to have a murder rate like we do. And some people have just sort of resigned and said, well, you know, people are going to kill people. I don't believe that. And there's a lot of people who in the community don't believe that either. They believe that it takes strong leadership not to just identify one program and say, oh, this is going to fix it. You know, it has to be comprehensive, and it has to be long term. It has to be, you know, it has to be the absolute conscience of this city has to be in correct shape in order to address this problem.
Mike Mendenhall.
I mean, it Jacksonville, you know, the as far as, you know, the violent crime is concerned, it seems to continue to grow. There's you know, where I think I believe Nate and I were talking off air this morning, and you said that we've hit 149 murders this year, I believe, which is two away from the record, I believe. Is that what
I think 2007 was 151, and that was, I think, the most since we've been tracking it,
which triggered the Jacksonville journey.
Yeah,
you know, so I mean, and really, to be honest. This is what the mayor and the sheriff campaigned on, you know, keeping our citizens safe. And if we're holding people accountable, then we need to start there. I mean, if people are going to get out here and say they're going to do something about a problem, then we have to hold them accountable for that problem, you know, and not just, you know, those two individuals, but the entire community. But if you say you're going to do something, you have to be wholly responsible for what's going on and how you invest and how you approach that issue.
Certainly, Mayor Curry's term limited. We'll see what Mike Williams decides to do with his career. But whoever runs for mayor in the next cycle, they're going to have to address this. They're going to have a plan. They're going to have to talk to the community about what they will do, working in concert with law enforcement and community groups to make this city safer. Because this is a public health threat to this city.
You know, the John Payton as mayor, I think, looks better and better every year to a lot of people for a lot of the fiscal decisions that he made to that really stabilized the city's finances, particularly in the run up to the recession. And the journey is part of that legacy. The one part of it that was a failing, and that I think, you know, like I don't think any sort of like Paytonites would even argue with anymore, is that it lacked a dedicated funding source. And that is every mayor is going to want to come along and rebrand the journey. Alvin Brown did it. Lenny Curry with this Kids Hope Alliance is just reshuffling pieces that were already there. But the lack of money continues, and the dedicated funding source is the thing that will endure beyond a mayoral administration and beyond hokey branding. And that is the thing that's not being done.
Yeah.
Because it's not a priority.
Almost like a Marshall Plan for distressed neighborhoods, family breakdown, trying to stop violence before it begins. The Cure Violence Program, Nikisha, has been brought to Jacksonville to try to get a handle on that. But it's a Band-Aid on a gushing wound, I think it's fair to say.
We have a lot of programs in the city aimed at trying to reduce the rate of violent crime in Jacksonville. Cure Violence, the real-time crime cameras, when we got Niven, ShotSpotter, the microgrants from the Kids Hope Alliance. But there doesn't seem to be a cohesive unit of unifying all of these different programs. You have the law enforcement aspect on one side, so we're beefing up what we're doing to react to the crime and maybe try to stop it before it happens with Cure Violence, which has just got started with 6-7 months ago. So we're still trying to see the long-term effects of that. And then it's with KHA, they get money, they don't have money, they get money, they don't have money, they get started, something happens, it's a change of administration, and it starts all over again. And the people who are being affected by the crime and that live in these communities don't have time to waste while the city gets its ish together. Mm-hmm. They just don't have that time. You're losing children, you're losing parents, you're losing grandparents, you're losing teens, and the streets don't stop. The streets are always calling. They're always recruiting. And if you can't get it a legal way, or you don't have a way out through schools because your school building is falling apart, I know we'll get to that in a minute, then you're going to find another way. And if you come from the gutter and people say that that's where you're going to stay, then that's where they end up staying. And it has to be a comprehensive thing that the city has to look at, not just police our way out of it, not just throw money at it, not just expect the community to do it on its own, but all of that has to come together. I mean, we had, what was the commission that they formed with like 40 some odd people to just think of ideas? And what was the result of that?
Yeah, they're still meeting.
They're still meeting.
And really, to Nate and Nikisha's point, the journey, when it started, was funded at a level of about $32 million. And I was on the journey oversight committee. When I left 8 years later, we were down to $2.5 million. Mm-hmm. And so a dedicated funding source. It was a comprehensive plan for moving the community forward. And at its height of funding, after only 4 years, I think in 2011, our murder rate had gone down to like 70%.
And that's the other component that's missing, consistency.
Yeah,
and, we don't have any consistency.
And lots of calls as we talk about the biggest stories of the year across Northeast Florida. Let's take a few more of you out there. Jody is in San Pablo. Jody, thanks for holding. Go ahead. Go ahead, Jody. You're on the air.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hey, thank you so much, Melissa, for running an award-winning show. And I love WJCD. And also,
thanks.
Congratulations to Greta Thunberg, who's a vegan and a climate activist, for winning Times Person of the Year award. As you all know, animal farming creates severe pollution greater than all modes of transportation combined. So why aren't people going plant-based to reduce their carbon footprint, improving their health, and being kind to the animals?
Sure. You know, I appreciate the call, and I didn't have it on my list, but climate change and how the city is responding to it or not is another big story from this year. So I'm glad that you called, Jody. Not everyone out there supports a plant-based diet, although they probably should. It's a healthier for you and the planet, and it does play a role in reducing emissions. You know, the city does have a resiliency committee now in the Jacksonville City Council, Mike, and they are starting to look at these issues years behind other major Florida cities, I might add, but they are starting to look at climate change.
Yeah, and I believe Matt Carlucci is going to be chairing that committee, City Councilman Matt Carlucci, and so they're going to have to look at both policy and implementation, and so there are going to be fortifying downtown from sea level rise of the St. John's River, and they're really going to have to bring in stakeholders from outside the city government, especially the business community. I mean, you look at for example Maxwell House plant downtown, when the creek overflows during daytime flooding and during high tide. I mean, it's going to cost these businesses a lot of money. So there really needs to be investment, and this committee really needs to be bringing in stakeholders from outside of the city government.
Linda is in Deerwood. Linda, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you. I wanted to actually commend the media, as well as this episode with JEA, has shown that experience on city council also means a lot. I think having Matt Carlucci and Brenda Priestley Jackson back on the council, who's been on there before, who knows how things, even in a dysfunctional city, they know how things shouldn't work. And I think that pressure from both sides was necessary. And also, let's be frank that there is no substitute for public service. We have, I think, leaders in our city that are politicians, but they haven't shown themselves to be public servants. And I think the next time around, somebody should not be able to claim a mandate with 14% when they don't show the soft skills necessary to negotiate compromise amongst different venues. So for the city, kudos to you guys breaking this to light and really getting the public desire in front of the politicians, because up until this week, it seemed like they were just like, hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil. Thanks, guys, and you are stellar.
Well, thank you, Linda. Thank you for that. We appreciate that. Here's a tweet from John. We need to improve our public schools, bring jobs to the North Side, and most of all, care about our kids and their future. Poverty and lack of hope breeds crime. Now, Linda mentioned in her call, Charles, that media outlets in this city kept highlighting controversies that reflect the will of the voters, whether it's not selling JEA or another big story from the year. Most voters in Duval County are in support of a referendum that would let them decide on whether we should levy a half-cent sales tax to improve and shore up aging public school buildings across this city. This is another example of a controversial story from the year where critics say our elected representatives seem to be ignoring the will of the voters in slowing the roll of this half-cent sales tax referendum that the school system wants.
Well, obviously the half-cent sales tax is very popular. Referendum is very popular. But even beyond that, The GAA issue was a campaign issue during the recent mayoral race. And all of the candidates, I believe except one, stated that they weren't in favor of selling GAA, and including the mayor during that time. He said that he wouldn't bring a bill forward to do that. That translated into, I'm against it. In the minds of most people. Now, it's up to the public to decipher or dig deeper and figure out how a candidate is you know, stands on an issue. But that notwithstanding, once it became more and more unpopular, then people expect for you to respond to that, just like with this referendum to improve the schools. The argument that's being made, obviously, is that by the city council is that we need more details. Mm-hmm. They've gotten probably more details about the half-cent sales tax than they had about JEA, and still couldn't get it through. So some would say the folks who are against it did their job in running out the clock on it to get it to the upcoming November, next November's election cycle. Mm-hmm. But moving forward, I think that there's probably some regret in some council members' mind regarding that issue, because we could have been on our way to improving our schools in this district by now.
Nate. Now,
I think that, you know, this past year has just been such a tremendously bad look for the city, you know, even from like a economic development perspective. You know, I thought it was interesting, the Civic Council, its statement calling for a grand jury did not just ask for a probe into JEA. They mentioned lobbying consulting practices in the city. And I think that is beginning to catch on as a real, if nothing else, perception issue, that what drives the sort of political agenda in this town is very mysterious. And it does sometimes seem to boil down to how people are getting paid. And, you know, I you know, this look that, you know, the strings are being pulled by some rogues gallery of greedy hucksters is just not a way to attract business investment to the city. It's not a way to make people feel good about where they
live.
Here's
a comment on Facebook from Susan. The school board needs to resubmit the referendum with a November 2020 ballot date. The JEA debacle has taught us that the greedy and corrupt will find loopholes. They need to safeguard our sales tax money. Okay, Mike.
You know, it'll be interesting to see, and I'm curious to see if how this JEA debate affects the decisions of our elected leaders moving forward. I know that if the city council learns from this public backlash when the referendum for the half cent sales tax does come back in 2020, will they go back to the drumbeat of getting a dedicated funding stream for charter schools? And we're already starting to see little bits of effect. I know that the DIA board, and it's a small thing, but the DIA board the other day decided to withdraw a resolution that would have amended an incentive plan for the Maxwell House plant. It would have allowed them to get almost $1 million, even though they didn't hit job targets. The rationale they used for repealing that back was JEA, and they're trying to be more attentive. So I mean, you're already starting to see that a little bit. I mean, it's a small thing, but
yeah, well, imagine that.
Yeah, if the council wanted to end whatever, you know, disagreement or shenanigans that's going on with the half cent referendum, they could bring their referendum back up, put it on the ballot and get an earlier date and move forward. But it's playing out in the courts right now, so everybody's sort of waiting. Everything's on pause. But you can end that. It wouldn't be a need. Wouldn't be any need for any court decisions if they put it back and brought it back as a bill and moved it forward.
Nikisha,
there's no need for it now. It's 11 days left in the year. It does not. There's no more election for 2019 to do it. So I mean, they're arguing over whether or not they have the legality to even ask for it or to sue for it. Just have the issue brought back up so it can be on the ballot for 2020, which is what the mayor wanted in the first place.
All right.
I think a court decision, too, would really, though, set precedent for any type of future, you know, issues that kind of relate to this.
So, sure. Yeah. Now, if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, our last one of the year and the decade. And your calls, it's myself, Nikisha Williams, Charles Griggs, Nate Monroe, and Mike Mendenhall. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Getting lots of tweets about JEA. I'm seeing them, everybody. I'm just can't get to them all because we are moving on to discuss a few other news and notes from the year. Another big story from 2019 was the pace of downtown demolitions, from the teardown of the Jacksonville Landing, which is still going on, to other urban core buildings and the push to the new development over at Lot J by the Jaguar Stadium. This is a story we followed all year. Mike Mendenhall at the Jax Daily Record in particular follows downtown development. And how do you see this trend impacting the city over time?
Well, it's definitely Mayor Curry's policy to remake downtown in his vision. And, and again, we talk about public criticism. The Jacksonville Landing is another example of, there was a lot of voices that didn't necessarily want the landing demolished. Now, there could be an argument as whether or not the landing would be reusable, but it kind of goes to the overarching policy of demolishing the riverfront, rebuilding it, but then also taxpayer back incentives to entice businesses. And that's going to be the question moving into 2020. Some of these big projects, particularly Lot J, where you're talking about $233 million in taxpayer backed incentives, how are we going to pay for it?
I've even seen people theorize that they believe the reason for the push to privatize JEA was so that Lot J could be paid for. Nate Monroe, there's no evidence of that. Another theory is that the mayor's office wanted to privatize JEA so that the city could deal with its pension obligations. So all of these stories tie together, basically, is what I'm saying.
I think those theories just like stem from the simple fact that the city is functionally broke and only has every year a tiny amount of leeway with its general fund because of rising property values. But, the city in its current state really has no business providing a private developer $200 million. And so I think people are just connecting dots, and it's hard
right.
to blame
yeah,
them for
people
that.
Are trying to follow the bouncing ball.
And also because there was really no definition given in the beginning why we would even need to sell JEA outside of, we're looking at a strategic process going forward, right? Because we feel like, the sky is going to fall in 10 years. If you give people a reason and you give them an opportunity to ask questions about that and be a part of that process, then perhaps maybe folks would have have seen more support for this process. But you didn't know what are you going to do with the money? If we get $5-7 billion, what are you going to do with the money? And so now people are allowed to speculate all of these reasons why this is being pushed through.
A few billion dollars could go a long way in this city. Lot J, the pension fund, the riverfront, the north side. It could go a long way to do a lot of good. And that plan has just never been put forth, which is unfortunate. And it's unfortunate that we're in this position now, because if you can make the case for it and say, here's what we're going to do with the money when we sell it, and this is how we'll help the community, I think you get people on board with that. And like going back to the issue of like the downtown demolition, we have a really pretty city. And it's unfortunate that we can't show it off because you've got rubble everywhere from the Liberty Street collapse from years ago that's still not completely done. The landing's coming down. The old courthouse building came down. You've got all these signs that say Riverwalk and you want people to come down here. The Lower Street Trio is finally being rehabbed. The Barnett building is back open. You've got a pretty vibrant downtown community when you want to have one. When there are events, people do come and they show up and they show out. But there's nothing to sustain that. And it's like, okay, tear it down, but then what are you going to build there?
I actually wonder, going back to Lot J for a moment, and like Mike might have a better insight into this than I do. I expected legislation on Lot J much earlier than, the DIA hasn't approved anything. Nothing's been introduced, and the city council hasn't. There must be something kind of weird going on with that.
Well, from what we know, is that they're still trying to work out the finer details of the base term sheet has not been approved, but it's been released. But it's the finer details. We're not sure whether it's financing, whether it's I know that the Downtown Investment Authority was expecting to see the Lot J deal before the end of the year. Now, originally they said that they were hoping to break ground on Lot J by January. When I interviewed Mark Lamping a few months ago, that date was pushed back to the end of the first quarter, if not into the second quarter of next year. So there's clearly holdups, and it's speculation, but it could be the fact that you know, we need to pay for figure out how to pay for these incentives.
Let's take one more call. It's Kurt. Oh, we lost Curtis on the north side, but I, Curtis, I appreciate you trying to call in. Speaking of Lot J, the Jaguars dominated discussion all year long, too. From Jalen Ramsey to the team's losing season to Shad Khan's various moves and capping it all off with the firing of Tom Coughlin this week. It's been quite a year for the Jaguars. Charles.
It's been quite a year for the Jaguars. And I don't know, just people call me crazy, but I believe this team is cursed. So
it's been
this way. You know, you've got, you know, they've won just about 40% of their games since they've been here.
All we lack is a story like the Billy Goat or the Bambino.
Yeah.
We need some kind of myth to arise. I don't know. Someone come up with something.
They've ended up being like the perpetual losers of the NFL. And, you know, you think about it really more deeply. No one really in the league, in the NFL, now respectfully, no one in the NFL really cares about Jacksonville Jaguars.
Well, what about NFL telling players, because of Tom Coughlin's alleged overreach with labor disputes, that they're telling players, don't go to the Jaguars. You might want to think twice about that.
Yeah, that was honest. I mean, that's a very tight-knit community. Once you become a member of a player in the NFL, it's a very tight-knit community. It's just like the owners are, and they look to protect each other. And so, I mean,
it's not a good look, though, for this franchise. Not a good look.
I think I've had to say before, like, I generally abstain from public discussions about the Jaguars because I'm a Saints fan. I mean, there were a million reasons to get rid of Tom Coughlin before this week, so...
Not a Merry Christmas for him, but it certainly did cap off quite the year. Now, before we wrap it up, before we go to break, we're going to go around the panel and do a quick lightning round as we look ahead to 2020. Mike Mendenhall, what's on your radar for next year?
Well, we talk about downtown development and the First Baptist Church property downtown, that 13 acres. It looks like it's going to be developed as one piece. Yeah, one piece.
So watch to see who buys it.
Exactly.
Nate.
In all candor, I think JEA is still going to be occupying a lot of my time next year.
It's going to be a big story next year. Nikisha.
I'm looking forward to the election. All of them. Primaries, generals. Bring it on.
That's right. It's going to be a big election year. And Charles.
And I'm still looking at the murder rate. I want to see the community do something tangible, something significant to do something about that.
Well, thank you all so much for closing out the year with us here on this final show of 2019. You guys are the best. Thank you, Charles Griggs, Nikisha Williams, Nate Monroe, and Mike Mendenhall, and have a wonderful holiday.
Thank you.
A quick break, and up next, MoCA's latest Project Atrium installation as we speak with local artist Kedgar Volta. That's next. Don't go away.
Hogan of the Tara Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. Holiday shopping helps share the joy of the season with family and friends, but some toys are defective. Our website has links to help avoid dangerous toys.
More at TaraHogan.com.
Live Nation presents the Doobie Brothers in concert at Daly's Place on Friday, June 12th, 2020. Showtime, 8 p.m. The Doobie Brothers with hits like What a Fool Believes. Daly's Place on June 12th, 2020. Tickets available at Ticketmaster.com.
Right now, above our heads, floating in space, there are thousands and thousands of pieces of space junk. I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, how we can reduce, reuse, and recycle when it comes to satellites and space debris. Plus, how mistletoe, a parasitic plant, became a holiday icon. It's all on Science Friday. from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.9 WJCT.
4 months and counting that the top job in U.S. intelligence has not been filled. Does it matter?
It is definitely a problem that the president has not nominated a permanent Senate-confirmed DNI.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, taking stock of the DNI role this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
The Senate is, to quote Alexander Hamilton, the court, the whole court. What can we expect when Chief Justice John Roberts presides over the trial of President Trump? It's been a week for the history books, but plenty more happened besides impeachment. The Friday News Roundup next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, MoCA Jacksonville's latest installation in its Project Atrium series is a large-scale reactive light and sound piece. It's called The Fragility of the Promise, and it was created by local artist Kedgar Volta. This installation will be featured prominently in the museum's big New Year's Eve celebration, so you can come out and check it out yourself. We're pleased to welcome artist Kedgar Volta to Studio 5 with more. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me here today.
Thank you for being with us. And this is a light and sound installation in MoCA's Project Atrium, and it explores the paradigm of success. Can you explain what your inspiration was and what people will see when they come out and check this out?
So every work that I create comes from a very personal place. And at the time I got the invitation to participate in the Project Atrium, I was reflecting of all these external forces that are present all the time and what it really means to be successful and what it takes to get there. Mm-hmm. So the installation is a tribute to all and everything that surrounds me. It's the people, it's the place, and the lighting represents each one of them and how those external forces come at the time to help you to make something successful or not.
Now, you installed more than 1,000 LED fixtures. They are suspended from the ceiling in concentric circles, and people can interact with them, and there's a message there. Can you explain how it works?
So the piece is called The Fragility of the Promise, and the promise could change from person to person. So the promise is yours. It's very personal, as it was for me. So even building the piece itself, the idea was to... how can all these forces that are external can influence the success of something? In this case, let's say the work itself. I got so much help from the community, from people from the community, Keith Marks, Mark McCombs, Adianis Garcia, and countless of volunteers that made the work happen. If it wasn't for them, the promise of finishing the piece mm-hmm. was fragile. So imagine that applied to any aspect of your life, how important it is to be surrounded by the right people, by the right community.
Success is a team effort in so many ways.
No doubt.
Now, and you find that to be true with your design company, Castano Group. Tell us about that.
So Castano Group is an experiential agency. We create work that interacts with the audience, utilizing really advanced technology, utilizing sensors, but more importantly, creating a message that opens up the opportunity for conversation between the work itself and the people that are in front of it.
And what is it about large-scale installations that attracts you, working in this big open space to create something completely breathtaking?
First of all, it's a challenge. I don't think I set myself to create large-scale work necessarily, but it always ends up happening that there's something about the complexity of an execution that ultimately when it's finished, it feels like a cohesive and simple work to appreciate, but the process itself is extremely attractive for me. That is large scale.
You like the challenge of it.
No doubt.
Now, people can come see this anytime at MoCA. All they have to do is walk in the door and look toward the atrium, but you will also be showing this out at the MoCA New Year's Eve party. This is for the adventurous, the visionary, and the creatives of our city. Tell us about the Big Bash.
So the Big Bash will happen from 9 to 1 a.m. On Christmas Eve. There will be, it's presented by Haskell, which is fantastic. And we'll have a open bar and live music, and people will experience the installation as part of the dancing floor. The dancing floor will actually be underneath the piece.
So this will be kind of like almost a psychedelic trip for people as they're dancing under these flashing lights. And it sounds really exciting.
I think it will be a wonderful experience.
Very diplomatic answer. Now, dress is creative glam, no black tie required. You can go to Eventbrite to get tickets to Mocha's New Year's Eve party and check out the work of Jacksonville-based artist Kedgar Volta. His large-scale light and sound installation is in the project atrium. It's called The Fragility of the Promise. And you can meet him on New Year's Eve, too. I'm sure you'll be there.
I will be
Bells
there.
On. So kudos, and have a wonderful holiday and a wonderful new year. And thank you for being here.
Thank you very much. Merry Christmas.
That's our show. Thanks for listening all year long and all decade long. And thanks to all of our guests and callers as well. This show's producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum directs the show. Jessica Palumbo is WJCT's news director, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Keep those emails coming. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We value your feedback. And make sure to tune in today at noon. It's our statewide call-in show, the Florida Roundup, where we look at the biggest issues across the state from the week. Today at noon, we'll look at proposed cuts to Florida's food stamp program, and also talk to the representatives from Florida Counts. They're worried that an undercount of the census in 2020 could cost this state a lot of money and even representation in Congress. That's all coming up at noon. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. As I said, this is our last show of the year and the decade. We are going to take a couple of weeks off, and we will be back to kick off 2020 at 9 a.m. on Monday, January 6th. Looking forward to connecting with you then. Have a safe and happy holiday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.